from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Where does the modern world and its ideas originate? Set against our inheritance of classical and medieval cultures in the West, such questions continue to stimulate discussion among scholars. For instance, the 400 years between the 12th and 16th centuries in Europe gave rise to cultural polarities that, in the words of one modern observer, separate the old mysterious supernatural universe of the earlier Middle Ages and a conviction that life, the world, and even God are intelligible to the human understanding. Out of such a polarity, for example, emerge conceptions of human reason as a divine gift by which to make one's way in this world and as a guide to life in the next. Two Italian poets provide important illustrations of some of the transitions that occurred between the medieval and the modern worlds. They are Dante and Petrarch, whose lives and work cover the years between 1265 and 1374. Dante and Petrarch are the subjects of the two following segments on this edition of Soundings. First, a conversation about Dante with Robert Hollander of Princeton University. Second, a discussion about Petrarch and his world with Ronald Witt of Duke University. Robert Hollander is a trustee of the National Humanities Center. At Princeton University, he's a professor of European and comparative literature. Robert Hollander specializes in the poetry of Dante, about whom he has written books and articles. Let me get into our conversation. Just refresh our cultural memory here. Dante was who, when did he live, and what is this work that we're about to discuss? Right.
Dante Alighieri was born in 1265 in Florence, Italy. Mm-hmm. He died in 1321 in Ravenna, where he was buried. His most famous work is the Divine Comedy. It was originally called by him the Comedy of Dante Alighieri. The adjective divine was added in 1555 by one of the editors. Uh-huh. It is arguably, and I don't want to argue this with anyone because they're partisans of various other poets, it is arguably the greatest poem ever written. There are a number of people, at any rate, who think it is. His poem describes his visit to the underworld, hell, to the mountain of purgatory, and eventually through the nine spheres of heaven until he reaches the Empyrean, where the saints live in the presence of God. I think it's fair to say, no analogs to that poem. That is, no one has ever written so ambitious, so daring, a poem with so vast a subject. The entire universe, the poem takes place in 7 days, in some way mirroring the 7 days of creation, and attempts to be, one can feel it, attempting to be an encyclopedic poem, a book in which everything is contained, which is a medieval phrase, and it's certainly one which was originally applied to the Bible, but you can feel Dante hoping that you might want to apply it to his poem also.
Now, the first time you did an appearance on Soundings, we talked about Dante. We talked about really what's in the poem, what makes it peculiar, what makes it the aesthetic and the structural elements, I suppose, that set it apart from and that make it noteworthy in the body of world literature. This time, let's talk about the nature of the text. I understand that here is a poem that hundreds of people have written about trying to. Well, tell me about the nature of the commentaries.
Actually, thousands of people have mm-hmm. written about it. The bibliographical tradition, which exists upon the corpse, as it were, of Dante's poem, is enormous. At Cornell, the greatest single Dante collection in the world happens to be at Ithaca, New York, in the Cornell Library. A wonderful collection. There are over 13,000 items there dedicated to Dante alone. When we talk about commentaries, we're talking about a very special kind of criticism, that is line-by-line appreciation of the meaning of the details and sometimes of the larger contours of the poem. And we have roughly 120 commentaries, and that's excluding those editions which give endnotes at the bottom of the page explaining words. But commentaries try not only to explain the philology, the meaning of a particular mm-hmm. word, but the concept behind that word. And we have roughly, worth dealing with, something like 120 separate commentaries to the poem.
Let's come to a passage, and let's talk about Dante. and then talk about it. Fire away.
What I've done to you is given you some homework and asked you to read not a passage that I would guess anybody would assign to a class who anyone who was interested in touching on great moments in Dante's poem. This is a very unimportant moment, or one that seems to be a very unimportant moment in the poem. And I'd like to do this little exercise with you to attempt to demonstrate that hidden in the depths of even the most minor seeming moments of the poem, there are claims that have considerable importance and which can raise in us considerable excitement. Now, the scene is this. Dante has almost finished his descent into hell. He's being led by the Roman poet Virgil, a circumstance of considerable interest on which we won't touch today. And they're coming down to the last of the 10th pouch, 10 pouches, which constitute the penultimate zone of hell.
What do you mean, pouches?
That's a technical name. He calls them bulge, which could be translated pockets or pouches.
Now, these are physical places.
In hell, yes. There is a geography of hell. Almost every edition of the comedy has a carefully drawn map of hell. That's how precise Dante's imagination is.
Did he draw these?
No, he didn't draw it, but in the 11th canto of the Inferno, he has Virgil in a wonderful comic moment. Virgil stops with Dante and says, now we're going down further into hell, but the smell is so terrible there that you'd better wait for a minute here until your nose gets used to it. A very sort of modern little bit of funny business that Virgil and Dante perform for us. And at that moment, Virgil gives the diagram of hell in words, and that is the source for the many diagrams that you will find in any particular edition of the Inferno.
So what's going on in this
passage? We are down at this
here?
Penultimate level of hell. And this is what Dante says. We descended onto the last bank of the long crag, keeping ever to the left, and then my sight was clearer down into the depth, where the ministress of the High Lord, infallible justice, punishes the falsifiers whom she registers here. Now, that's going to be hard to listen to for people who are listening to this broadcast.
So what he sees is an agent of justice punishing fraudulent sinners.
Exactly.
The sin of deceit, is that
he
it?
He doesn't see that. He points to the zone where that is happening, where the ministress, the female minister of the High Lord, God, infallible justice is her name, punishes the falsifiers, and now the difficult little piece of Dantean poetry, whom she registers here. Whom she, justitia, justice, registers here.
That's a little adverb, isn't it?
The adverb here.
Is the problem?
What does it? Yeah. In fact, in the commentary tradition, there are of those that I have bothered with. There are, I think, 37 who say that it refers to this world, and 45 or thereabouts who say that it refers to the bulge. That is this 10th bulge where Dante
that one specific
are
place
now arriving. Yes.
Yeah.
You have any opinions?
Well, here could mean also in the largest and the most cosmic of senses, couldn't it?
Where?
The human consciousness. Couldn't it mean
that? Well, not so bad. No commentator has suggested that, Wayne, so it's a first that, that you have put forward. But think about the verb register, registrare, in Italian. That's a word that calls attention to the bookish nature of things. A register, even in English, is, for instance, a cash register, not the kind you ring up.
A catalog.
Exactly.
Right.
Daniello, in 1568, one of the important Renaissance commentators, speaks about merchants and thinks that this has an overtone of what a merchant does in keeping business records. And after Daniello, others came to understand that that verb keys us to something, to the bookish nature of the at least implicit metaphor, whom she registers here, whom she marks down in her register here. But where's here? None of them.
Not the book itself.
The book itself. Why not the book itself?
Well,
what makes better sense than the book itself? But he, on a dozen other occasions, or I guess 10 other occasions in the course of the poem, uses the adverb here to speak of his narrative, what he is writing. Now, I would submit that the reason that you're arguing with me, whether you've understood it or not, and the reason that the dozen or so commentators who have further understood that the reference implicit here is to the book of Revelation, to the book of life, which is opened and on which the names are registered of those who will be saved and those who are not written in the book of life. It's Revelation 20:12.
Those who are washed in the blood of the Lamb.
Right. And there are those who are written in the book of life, and those others who are not written in the book of life who will be cast down into the pit where we're looking now. The pertinence of the book of Revelation to the notion of names being registered in a book is very great here. That's clear, and a dozen commentators have seen it. But none of those commentators has paused to think that the here in question is the here that they hold in their hands, this book, except for one in 1416, a Franciscan commentator, one John of Serravalle, a very interesting commentator. One, he describes writing in his commentary of the Purgatory, writing with a Neapolitan aristocrat, and holding in his own hand some of Virgil's bones. A strange moment, but a rather beautiful one. This is John of Serravalle coming upon this passage, simply says, here in this book, in the quaternary, he calls it, in this book, the author is talking, and he's talking about his own book. John said that in 1416. No commentator has paid any attention at all to what he said. I found no one has paid any attention to what he said. And yet I submit he is obviously correct that there one has to be careful. This is a poem. Poems have a way of shifting their meanings depending on who looks at them. But here there is only one reading that really makes a great deal of sense.
And that's to assign the word here to the book itself.
To the book itself. Now, the more interesting question, I mean, if you'll come along with me on that, the more interesting question is, why have we not seen it? Why has only one commentator seen it? And if he's seen it, why has no one picked up on what he's seen? And I think there's a reason for that. This is slightly more venturesome. If the best comparison we can find for this moment lies in the book of Revelation, we think about what that comparison suggests. What is Dante suggesting, if this here means his text, about the nature of that text? Seems to me that he's suggesting that it has the sort of currency, has the kind of status that we have previously, if we are in a Christian literary tradition,
given to
assigned
the Bible.
Only to the Bible, only to the Bible alone and no other text. Mm-hmm. And I would submit that the reason commentators have had such a difficult time and have argued for so long over meaning A or meaning B without seeing meaning C yet being alive to its possibility is precisely because, at least unconsciously, they've understood what the claim implicit in that little adverb here has for the status of the whole poem, not only this particular passage. What Dante would seem to be maintaining, at least according to my interpretation, is that his poem is inspired by the Holy Spirit. His poem, as opposed to classical literature, as opposed even to the work of Virgil, has a privileged status, is unlike any other poem you have ever read, that it is capable of registering in its pages the truth that you would find if you survive the last days as a conscious entity and can see what happens when God disposes of our lives.
Isn't this a sort of a heretical position?
Sure.
Why didn't the church come down hard on him first?
The church didn't understand that that was the strategy that lay behind
the poem.
He's
talking about himself as a revelator.
I think that's true.
He's putting himself, if not into a prophetic position, he's putting himself into a, divinely interpretive position, and inviting the reader to see in his text, in effect, the words of God.
But not every reader. The defensive posture that Dante takes for himself.
He's hedging.
Is to make you do it, to make us do just what we've done. Insofar as you or anyone listening buys this understanding of the line, what we would admit is that there was nothing in the passage which immediately made it evident that that's the best reading. We had to work for it. We had to analyze it and come up with a solution which seemed to us clearly superior, and then go on to say, well, my goodness, if that's true, then this text is trying to achieve the same status that we accord only to Scripture. And when we get to that, and if we agree to that, we are the ones who have done it. Nowhere in this poem does Dante ever say this poem is written with divine inspiration. Yet I would argue in a good dozen passages in it, we see that that is precisely the implicit claim that it's making. The church's position, insofar as the Commedia was on the index for several hundred years, but what seems to have put it on the index was the fact that Dante put popes in hell. That was the one overt gesture which got him into hot water. The claims made by the poem certainly would have gotten him into hot water had they been understood. In my view, they were not, because he made them in a very clever way. He made them in a hidden, a guised way, so that we had to unravel them. He didn't come out and say them blatantly. Putting popes into hell, he did blatantly. Canto 19 shows us three popes, a very funny and bitter scene. And there is no mistaking his intention there. It is to attack those particular popes, if not the institution of the papacy.
Isn't there a sin of intellectual or literary pride
sure.
at work here?
Now, you're asking me to make an objective judgment, which I would find difficult to make. From within the poem, the answer to it is no. That is, Dante
because
builds
he doesn't
in
make the claim. Is that
not
right?
Not only because he doesn't make the claim, but I think that within the givens of the poem, his claim is always that he is only recording what he saw, that the only specialness in him is that he was chosen by God to take this journey. That is the only thing that makes him special, and that makes him a kind of passively loved agent of divinity, rather than someone who has won laurels and thus been specially privileged. So that within the poem, he covers himself pretty well. And I must say, as a reader, as objective as I can be, reading objectively as I can, I'm convinced by that. I'm convinced that he's not being prideful. But when I get outside the poem and look at this poem as compared to all other poems, I'm afraid that I have to agree with you that the sin of maybe perhaps not the sin, but an activity that one could only imagine as being generated by a good deal of intellectual pride has been accomplished.
Robert Hollander is a professor at Princeton University, where he teaches European and comparative literature and specializes in the poetry of Dante, the Italian poet who lived from 1265 till 1321. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Following Robert Hollander's comments about Dante, Soundings now turns to a discussion about the life and work of the Italian Renaissance poet Petrarch, who lived from 1304 till 1374. Here is Ronald Witt, a professor at Duke University. Ronald Witt recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about the origins of Italian humanism.
The word humanism is one of those attractive terms invented by German academics in the early 19th century. Of course, today it's come to mean, have a very generalized meaning. Humane, man-centered, but in its origin, it is an academic term and refers to a range of disciplines taught at the university.
You mean it doesn't go all the way back, for instance, to the Renaissance? You hear about the Renaissance man, the humanist, the Renaissance person, I guess one should say.
Yes, the term humanismus is a 19th century term, but the word humanist has a longer history. In the 16th century, for example, it was very common to talk about the humanisti, someone who taught the studia humanitatis, the studies of humanity.
And now let's pause on that. What would those studies be, just very quickly?
They would be primarily literature, uh-huh. Both Greek and Latin, moral philosophy, and history.
Uh-huh. Now, tell me again how it would have been, I say it, how humanism would have been referred to in its time, in the 13th century. You said the study of literature and history and religion. Was there a kind of code word that was used in those days?
No, not in the early days. The Studia Humanitatis begins to appear in the mid-14th century with Petrarch. Earlier on, it's very difficult to find references to what these people are doing. It begins in the late 13th century as a movement in poetry. Uh-huh. That is an attempt to imitate ancient poetic forms and language.
Ron, tell me what would have been the goal of, you say Petrarch, I've always heard Petrarch, so I'm glad to have the record set
Petrarca,
straight on that.
Yes.
Okay. What was he after in his humanism?
Well, let me first give his dates, 1304 to 1374. Mm-hmm. He was a deeply religious person. His predecessors had not been primarily concerned with religion. They were primarily out to achieve beauty in their work. Petrarch, on the other hand, saw in the ancients both the gift of eloquence and the teaching of morality. And his object was to study the ancients, to read the morality contained within their works, and at the same time to be changed by the eloquence of the ancients. In other words, for him, the beauty of the ancient writers like Cicero or Seneca was was had an ethical element to it, but it also, because of its force, changed one's heart and one's mind to follow the ethical precepts that were found in the writing. Mm-hmm. And the humanists, in their own time, wished to develop their own ability to write eloquently so that they, too, could transform other people's lives through the word. Now, for Petrarch, it had a deep religious significance. Not only did he wish to make people better, but better human beings on this earth, but he also wished to make them better Christians. And that influence of Petrarch continues through the first three generations, to the first two generations after his death, until the beginning of the 15th century, when humanism changes in character and drops out the religious aspect.
Isn't it odd, as you say, that the religious angle would sort of drop out of view here if the idea is to change human society? I mean, this neglect of the spiritual element. Why did that seems paradoxical to me?
Well, I shouldn't exaggerate here. When I talk about the religious element dropping out, I'm talking about what I consider to be the major line in humanist thought in the beginning of the 15th century, which is centered in Florence. There, the humanists are not unreligious. They are not concerned, however, with the religious aspect. The focus of their humanism is on the improvement of man in society. Uh-huh. In other words, making men better through the state. This worldly concerns. That doesn't mean that these humanists cease to be religious, or that some of the humanists don't speak about theological concerns. But the major focus is on the problems of marriage, of the relationship of the individual to the state, the problem of wealth. Is it right to make money through business? All sorts of practical questions. There is a return dramatically in the last half of the 15th century in the mainstream of humanist thinking to religious problems. But then what has happened is we're dealing with the reintroduction of the Platonic corpus, and the Christian religion tends to get confused and blended with a good deal of Neoplatonic language and conceptions. Christianity really becomes is seen as one among a number of religions, the highest, the most perfect. But there is a tendency to see all religions as sharing in some very basic principles. And Christianity loses its character. What really happens is that original sin drops out. The darker, the underside of human nature tends to be lost. Now, this period lasts until the beginning of the 16th century. And then what we see is another major trend, and that is a trend to that is no longer concerned primarily with morality, nor concerned with religion, but rather with becoming the Renaissance individual, how to win friends and influence people. Now, it can be argued that all of these three things are going on at the same time. I mean, concern for religion, concern for morality, and how to win friends and influence people. But by the 16th century, I think that latter is the dominant concern. The Cortegiano of Baldassare Castiglione is a good example here. It was published in 1508. It had an enormous success. It deals with the courtier and how to become a successful courtier. There are moral aspects to it. The courtier is to advise the prince. He's to know how far he can give good advice to the prince, how far to hold back so he doesn't lose favor. But the courtier is taught how to tell jokes, how to win friends among the ladies, how to the various accomplishments that he must acquire. But there's really no base to this person.
Well, he's not glorifying God, is
no,
that
by
it?
No means. In yeah. fact, there is at the end of the Cortegiano, there is a Platonic ascent, a ladder of beauty that one mounts. In fact, at the very end of the Cortegiano, in the fourth book, there is a ladder of ascent of with beauty at the top, and the way one ascends to this absolute beauty, to this image of to this absolute beauty, is through the beautiful woman. She is the the door.
It sounds to me, Ron, as though you could be talking about the origins of sexism, you know, this elevation of women. Ron, let's move forward in time now and talk about humanism as it gets abused, the term as it gets used and abused today. Tell me why there's so much confusion over this. You've been talking about it in terms of a literary movement that had at one point and then fell away from a religious dimension. Why does this idea, why is it viewed as such a threat to some people?
I think, first of all, the idea of secular humanism, which is the major focus of criticism, has little or no connection with the Renaissance. The term really means human concern. In other words,
you mean as you've been using it?
I've been using it in a more as covering a range of disciplines, with closely connected then with an outlook on life. I think presently it's used in a very general way as just meaning to focus on life on this earth, mm-hmm. Without any kind of important historical connections.
Ron, you are a professor at Duke University. You teach history. You know a lot about the classics. You know about Petrarch. You know about Italian humanism. You have been a scholar at the National Humanities Center. Does that make you a humanist?
Yes, I'm a humanist.
Okay, and how do you think of yourself as a humanist?
Well, I see myself as a conveyor of a tradition, one of learning, and with an ethical connection. Mm-hmm. That is, I adhere to the classical. I adhere to the humanist belief that we are what we read. After all, the humanists established the educational tradition of Western Europe for the next 500 years, right down to the 20th century.
You're talking about education now.
I'm talking about education. Mm-hmm. That they were committed to the belief that there are certain works that are both eloquent and highly moral, and that we read these works, and that they cannot help but make us better people. In other words, there's an assumption that that writings, that books, change people's lives.
Let me ask you to reflect on this, Ron, without becoming altogether personal here. To be then a humanist, to be involved in the humanities, which, as you say, is a term that was invented for the convenience of academics, you pointed that out earlier in our conversation, does this necessarily make one a disbeliever or an unbeliever?
By no means. Some of the great books that I would include in my reading list are books that are deeply religious books. I would also, of course, include other books which are not. I think the duty of the humanist is to raise questions, because only by raising questions can a faith be really strengthened, mm-hmm. Challenged and strengthened.
Ronald Witt teaches at Duke University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about the origins of Italian humanism. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a two-part discussion about the Italian poets Dante and Petrarch. The Soundings panelists were Robert Hollander of Princeton University and Ronald Witt of Duke University. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Italian medieval and Renaissance poetry, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, Soundings on Medieval and Renaissance European Culture will continue. My guests will be Pamela Benson of Harvard University and Jasper Hopkins of the University of Minnesota. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first in a series of conversations about medieval and Renaissance European culture. In the polarities between the medieval and the modern worlds, the Italian poets Dante and Petrarch provide important illustrations of the transition from what one scholar calls the mysterious supernatural universe of the Middle Ages toward the conviction that life, the world, and even God are intelligible to the human understanding. Dante and Petrarch, poets of the Italian medieval and Renaissance culture. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.